This scenic beauty constitutes one of our nation's great resources, the heritage of natural splendor, which we must preserve for those who come after us. Help conserve another vital natural resource, we are also constantly developing more efficient methods to mine and process our mineral-bearing ores. When it comes to the conservation of most natural resources, we are a responsible people. We want to conserve our natural wealth. We cannot leave to the generations who will follow us an empty and wasted land.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Citizen Reporter. I'm your host, Mark Fonseca Rendeiro, and you have found the podcast that is all about human stories, struggles that teach us something about ourselves, how we got here, why things are the way they are. I'm sure many of you wonder that these days more than ever in this 2017 reality where, well, certain news stories dominate, and generally there's a dour, negative view of the future and maybe even the present. Today, on this very program, we're going back to India. Oh yeah, it's the South of Mumbai series. We're in the state of Karnataka, and the city is Mangalore. The guest is the great architect and activist Niren Jain. He did something amazing, and in many ways, perhaps he still is. He, and not alone, and a group of people who were passionate about the environment, who took action. And this is the story of their, I'm going to say, success, and also their struggle, because in a way, these stories do never really end, but there have been amazing chapters. So we visited Niren Jain in his home, which is also his office. A beautiful building. He is an architect, after all. A beautiful, beautiful building, which it was so wonderful to visit. And then we sat down and started with his story of from how he first started with his love of the environment and what that how that impacted him to eventually the story of Kudremukh, the national park, this massive tract of land in multiple states, including Karnataka. Let's go to the interview. And I'm going to jump in here and just explain where it went. But to begin with, we went for that classic question of, yeah, how did you, Niren Jain, and the environment, how did that connection, that love, how did it start?
Hi, I'm Niren Jain. I'm a practicing architect in Mangalore. That's southwest coast of India. And I've been active in wildlife conservation for last 15 years now. One of the reasons I'm in Mangalore and not in any other metro is that within an hour, I can reach about 6,000 to 7,000 square kilometers of Western Ghats. So Mangalore being the center, I can cover a huge range within an hour's distance. So that's just like a day trip, and I can cover a whole lot of places. That's one of the main reasons why I'm still here in my native of Mangalore. My mother is from a place called Bajagoli, which is the foothills of Kudremukh. You might have passed when you're coming from there. So we used to adore these hills when we were very small, jumping in the fresh water streams. And I always had a desire to climb up those mountains, but when we were small, our families are not very explorative here. They don't want you to go out, and they feel that some very isolated, very scary places. So I always wanted to visit them. But I got that opportunity only later after my high school days. So in my imagination, whenever we heard of Western Ghats, I thought at least that these were such a big forest that even if you walk for 10 days, you can't come out from the other end. But once you actually started trekking, you realize the entire Western Ghats, anywhere in Western Ghats, it's a day's march. You come out of the other place or you come out to a settlement. And that really shocked me. I never thought it had shrunk so much and we had so little left. Beyond that, I think it's the inspiration by D.V. Girish, who was working in Chikmagalur and Bhadra Wildlife Sanctuary. We have a very, very closed opinion about trying to work on such public issues. I mean, most of people whom we know, they think government is something that's alien. You can't really work. The forest department is something totally different. There's no way that you could try and change things on ground. But when I saw him work, I mean, even though it looked hopeless, but I thought it was trying. He was trying and probably doing some difference, and I was not doing anything. So that really inspired me to try and at least try and do something.
Now here, as we gradually move towards talking about this Kudremukh National Park, and indeed he's already begun to mention the people involved, there's also this element that I want to make sure listeners understand, and that is the big difference in what a national park is, how it works. For example, I've grown up in the United States, maybe you listening are in Germany or the Netherlands, and to my understanding, one thing we all have in common is these national parks where one option is to go there, to enjoy it. It's for people. And then, of course, there's the other option of preserving and not allowing that land to be spoiled, damaged. India, I've learned, and Niren will explain, but India has a different approach to national parks. And it's one that we encountered where, for example, we have to write the time that we arrive. It has to be recorded. And we have to be out of there within, I think it was 2 hours or is it 4 hours? Whatever it is, it's a very controlled amount of time. And what you can do while you're there is even controlled, where you can go. You might only be able to stay on the main road on a certain day or depending on what's going on. So there is a big difference here that Niren will explain.
Yeah. Unlike the term national parks that is applied in right. US, those are parks meant for people's usage, mainly. People are kind of encouraged to go and see there. Whereas in India, national parks hardly comprise about less than 2% of in total, less than 2% of the whole country.
Right, okay.
So that's very minuscule. And even within that, we allow people to go in and go all over the place. In fact, before those rules, in fact, we kind of encouraged the forest department to, there was no gate also there. So we encouraged the forest department to put that gate on the boundaries and also have restrictions for people going, because every weekend you would see hundreds of cars on the road. Everybody going with their beer bottles, playing loud music, throwing the trash. And it was a nightmare at that time. So, in fact, we encouraged the forest department, why don't we do this so that people don't stay there. Whoever wants to visit, they'll have to go to the rainforest officer, take a permission, go with a guide so that they get monitored as to so that they don't throw. See, if everybody's cultured and they behave nicely, there's no problem. But sadly, 99% of the people who visit these, whether you give them an amusement park or a national park, it wouldn't matter. There's just an outing for them, and that's a sad part. If everybody's sensitive, probably these rules need not be so strict.
So this is one element, the differentiation between what a national park is and how it works from perhaps your part of the world, whoever you are, listener, to what is going on in Karnataka and in India. The other element that I wanted to lay out before we get into the full story, which is just ahead, is this element of, you know, why is this national park so special? It's large, but as Niren points out, it's not so large, it's just large. But then there's this element of what and who lives in it, and the wildlife, the species of plants, and its function also is quite important. So this is just a thing here on the biodiversity of Kudremukh, which is significant.
Kudremukh, it's a very, I mean, not too many parts of the Western Ghats is studied very intensively for biodiversity and other wildlife. In fact, one of the first studies was done by Dr. Karanth itself, when they were claiming the lion-tailed macaques, which is highly endangered, and there's probably less than 3,000 monkeys left in the wild. They said majority of them, or the biggest population, is in Kerala, the Silent Valley part of it. But he took up a study in 1984, and he surveyed the entire North Karnataka and these areas. He found Kudremukh had one of the largest troops and a very sustained breeding population of lion-tailed macaques. And he followed up on his study, and later on in 1987, he pushed the government to declare that as a national park. So, and he was also telling stories in terms of how small their group was when the mining started. And the Silent Valley, which is just 90 square kilometers, at the same time had the hydroelectric power project proposal that time, and a whole lot of wildlife enthusiasts, and including Salim Ali, who was an ornithologist and a very well-known wildlife biologist. He convinced the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi to abandon the hydroelectric project in Silent Valley. But this kind of went by default. That time I was hearing from my other seniors who were involved in the campaign, like Purnachandra Tejaswi. He's no longer there, but he was telling that time it was declared as an emergency and they couldn't really protest and do any campaign at that time. And this went by default, whereas Silent Valley got saved. And later on, when they were doing an environment impact assessment of Kudremukh, they found that the biodiversity here, including vegetation diversity and other characteristics, were much higher than Silent Valley. Mm-hmm. But nobody did the study and nobody knew about it. So it kind of stands. And now it's about 1,200 square kilometers, which is including Kudremukh National Park and Someshwar Wildlife Sanctuary. It all comes as a compact block. So almost 1,200 square kilometers. That's one of the largest protected area in the entire Western Ghats.
So it's very important in terms of its function for the environment, but also as a habitat for species that can't be found anywhere else, especially, you know, with what's going on in India with the development and the cities getting larger and so forth. The other thing that's very unique, I would say, is that with the story of Kudremukh National Park, you have it becoming a national park in 1987. And Niden, we'll talk about these dates again. 1987, it becomes a national park. But, and here's something you won't hear in a lot of countries, back in the 60s, it actually was a location for mining. Actually, it started as a place for iron ore mining. So here we have this very environmentally important place, but it also has resources. And before it's even preserved officially, long before, decades before, it is first used, at least one section of it, as a source of mining minerals.
In 1967, the mining, they were given a 30-year lease for the mining. And that time, 1967, they were given a lease to mine. It was a public sector undertaking by the government of India. So they started exploring, and the lease was given in 1967 for 30 years. And the national park was declared much later, in 1987. So there was a 10-year overlap. So 1967 to 97, the lease ended. So in 1987, the national park was declared. So, once the lease ended, they had also exhausted the ore they were mining in that particular area, and they wanted to expand to the neighboring hills. And the government of India, as well as the state government, had initiated process and correspondence to start denotifying those areas where they want to mine, denotifying it as from the status of national park.
So that
they can enable expansion of the mining. So that's when we realized the present mining is in the catchment area of Bhadra River. And if you can imagine, we are almost on the west coast. And the Bhadra River originates here in the west coast. Mm-hmm. It goes all the way east and it goes to the eastern coast, which means you're mining right at the origin of River Bhadra. So the expansion area where they were asking for is another tributary. It's called the Tunga. So the origin of Tunga River also would have been damaged if those areas were denotified from the status of national park, and mining would have expanded to those areas. So that's when we realized that we can't keep quiet about this and we need to start something more serious in our campaign.
One of the interesting elements that I even referred to in the beginning of this program is that when you think about campaigns that take on a mining company, which are often very powerful in terms of their connections and their resources, resources. But when it comes to a campaign that also involves taking on the government, amazingly, this battle that Niden was involved in was not carried out by a mass movement of thousands and millions, but actually it was by a group, a small, relatively small group of active and committed individuals, each one of them with their own specialty in many ways, that made a difference.
Still, it is, I would say, especially in wildlife, it is still a very small community who are really fighting for the core values in wildlife. There are a whole lot of other environmental activists and environmental group that is working, which is much larger. But if you look at wildlife, you would know by people by names, and you would know who's where and what are they working on, what are their strengths and things like that. It's a lot more close-knit group in spite of we being such a huge population.
Yeah.
So that way, I think the networking was effective, very effective. And I wouldn't say everybody in the government, everybody in the forest department had encouraged this. It was the timing of those particular people being there, we being there. In fact, probably my timing also that I decided to take off full time in working in conservation at that particular time. Right now, I'm not working full time. Right. I'm kind of putting in part of my time in conservation. So a whole lot of things factored in and we took it forward.
In 2002, the battle that had been led by the NGO Wildlife First got a ruling from the Supreme Court that said the mine must be closed by December 2005, stating, quote, "By destroying nature, environment, man is committing matricide, having in a way killed Mother Earth. Technological excellence, growth of industries, economical gains have led to the depletion of natural resources irreversibly. Indifference to the grave consequences, lack of concern and foresight have contributed in large measures to the alarming position. In the case at hand, the alleged victim is the flora and fauna in and around Kudremukh National Park, a part of the Western Ghats. The forests in the area are among 18 internationally recognized hotspots for biodiversity conservation in the world." Unquote.
Yeah, we were quite thrilled once we got the Supreme Court judgment, but the mining stopped. They said they need to phase down mining within 5 years. That was so they did stop the mining in 2005. So after that, they continue to still hold the buildings there, and there are some very small number of staff who are still present there, and. But in these, so it's been 10 years since 2005 to 2015, and there's a big vacuum there. So once a big company goes, a whole lot of other people lying into that township, and a lot of people were interested to set up a resort there and come in as other players. So recently we also approached the High Court to prevent that from happening, because the mining company had given on a sublease. When they themselves didn't have a lease with the government, they gave it on a sublease because they were informally holding those buildings till they handed over to the government to another entity to run a tourism resort. Yeah. And they started claiming that it is their land, not the government land. So again, we had to go to the court, and finally we've got the order clearly stating that it is a government land and it needs to be handed over to the government, and the company cannot perpetually hold it.
This land of ours, this inspiring resource of beauty and space, is a fountainhead from which we draw new energy and enthusiasm for the tasks that lie ahead.
This would be the moment in the story where you say, well, wow, you know, something tangible and good came from this struggle. The mining was stopped, the Supreme Court ruled it. But before long, things would take yet another turn. And this time it was the very system that the group had been using to try and preserve and protect the park. That system gets turned against them.
So after we won the mining battle, the mining company went on a second appeal against that order, and we were kind of looking at it that okay, it's going to close and dates are coming closer, and there were officers shifted in the forest department, and there were some. So there was a kind of a backlash. We thought, okay, everything is going on very smoothly and we did such a big campaign and we were successful in it and this is great. But later on, as people changed within the system, they started coming back on us. Luckily, the order was in place. But they had gone on an appeal and they thought they could somehow get across in the appeal stage. So the forest department itself, and we were working so closely earlier, as immediately as the officers changed, they came back behind us instead of the mining company, which had encroached 3.4 square kilometers. And they were coming behind us telling, you had encroached 3 years back. You had trespassed into the national park without permission 3 years back. And they filed 14 criminal cases on us. In all those four courts where you took a long journey, coming back, one in Sringeri, one in Karkala, one in Mudgiri, and one in Beltangadi. And because the park is so big, you have so many different jurisdictions, so that would make us run around year-round in all these courts. And then it was a huge eight-year-long, very exhaustive battle in the High Court to kind of prove ourselves that these officers had malafide intention, and we got an order telling that it was malafide actions by these officers. And they had come to my office, raided my, seized my laptop and took all the information that we had planned and strategized to fight against this mining company. And so it was pretty bad times that time. And probably I was also very young and very hot-blooded that time, probably ignorant of our real strengths.
Yeah, yeah.
But we got through it.
Not to spend too much time going backwards here, I know you're listening, but this last part where Niren says, the police came and raided my offices and took computers and looked for documents, looking for evidence to use against him. And even what he mentioned before about there were people in the forestry department that invented moments in history in the past where he had broken rules. So myself, together with our colleagues, while visiting Karnataka, we went to Kudremukh, of course, before this interview. And indeed, I noticed, as we mentioned before, that the difference with the way the park works. And when you get to this entrance of any entrance of the park, there's someone who sort of writes down what time you came in, might even give you a little piece of paper that says it. And then, even though you're in that park for the hour or two that you are, when you come out, you're supposed to, again, see a guard, and that guard is going to write down when you left. Now, officially, legally, again, as Niren has tried to explain, you are supposed to be out within the allotted time, and if you're not, you could get fined. That is the breaking of a law. So here is something so routine in many ways that we got to experience that could, it's hard to imagine, but it happened, be used against you, where the forestry department produces a bunch of records that show that you checked in, went into the park, and didn't come out for many hours, maybe even days, which is illegal. So therefore, here, retroactively, you're in trouble, either with fines or worse. This is just one example of when the system started to get used against Niren. Now, at this point in the story, you know, I've really started thinking about what I've learned over the years when it comes to India. Of course, not enough, not much compared to what you know if you live it, if you're there, especially working on this issue. But at one point I asked Niren, because I remember from school, university, where I did some classes on Indian politics. I read my books, my Arundhati Roy, even my Gandhi to a certain extent. And what it seemed like, especially with Arundhati Roy and the 90s when I was in school, was that in India, what was happening was there were all these big projects for water, dams, energy, resources, and these projects would push and displace whomever, whenever. It didn't matter if hundreds or thousands of people lost their homes or were hurt. It was all about the infrastructure projects and the power and the will of the government. So I asked Niren, you know, if in this context, now 2017, compared to the 90s when all this stuff was going on with the dams, if that maybe nowadays you have a lot more tools and a lot more power to, I'll say, fight or at least be active for a cause when it comes to the environment. And to my great surprise, he didn't say, oh, it's a better time.
It's probably got worse.
Huh.
Because it's mainly because of the economic condition of the country. We have more power to spend. We have more capacity to get things done compared to when we didn't have, when our economic situation was not very good. We couldn't even think of such large-scale projects. So now infrastructure is very big time, and they're weakening a whole lot of forest conservation laws to encourage and enable these things. Earlier, I think there were, when you talk about wildlife, I think including, what I would say is including Indira Gandhi and Rajiv Gandhi, they were a lot more sensitive to wildlife and nature. And so the Project Tiger itself, where a whole lot of tiger reserves were established and there was a system established.
Which era was that?
I think it's 1970s, beginning of 1970s. So they established a whole lot of series of tiger reserves, and there was a specific funding for these areas, and a lot of areas were well protected, and at least the intention was there to by the government to kind of focus on these areas and protect them. But today those things are being diluted more and more.
This might be the point in the program as we wind down the story that you'd expect a resolution, right? A happy ending where you say, okay, there was this setback and it's been hard, but here's what we've been able to achieve. And indeed, we have mentioned some of the achievements, but the truth about this story that I'm presenting to you is that it is not over. There is no happy ending. It's ongoing. It is a struggle that continues. Now, one thing I did get to speak with Niren was the larger, even larger picture, from a large picture when it comes to national parks, to the larger picture of the relationship between people and the environment in India, and what's going on when it comes to cities getting bigger, or what's known as urbanization. And actually, I usually say rural to urban, this struggle, this movement. And Niren puts it differently. He talks about remote areas versus villages versus cities, and what's going on with that.
So I think it would be a lot more relevant in India with such a huge population, and people are all over the place. Like I said, that there is no forest that I would come out to any settlement within a day's march.
Mm-hmm.
So there's people all over the place. But today, when we talk to people who are living in really remote areas, so I call this remote, which is different than village. So India, the whole country would be a village because it's, you have villages all over the place. Whereas remote areas are a lot more isolated. When I say remote, it would mean about a walk for 7 kilometers in the forest without any house in between. I would say that is remote. For some other people in US, remote would mean even more deeper than that. So when I say remote in India, I'm talking of about 7 kilometers of walk without any road access, without electricity, without anything. So when we speak to such people, especially most of them are sending their children to school, either they walk or they leave them in their relatives' place or in some hostels. And the verses most of them are growing cash crops like arecanut and a whole lot of other things. It's not rice. Mm-hmm. Rice is not the major crop that they grow even in the remote areas. So they need to take these crops on head loads, carrying 7 kilometers on head load, and then putting it onto some transport, and then taking it to the closest market. And that's a huge task. And I was trying to understand, do some study on these remote areas for my master's recently, in terms of how much man hours do they put in compared to people who would be living just outside these, means 7 kilometers where public conveyance is available, electricity is available, hospitals are close by, schools are close by. So the man hours people put in remote areas is like far, far, far more. So
it's all day work.
All day. They just have no time for anything. So finally, they save comparatively little compared to if they would have been 7 kilometers in the places where all these amenities, basic amenities, are available. Mm. So that, and when we spoke to them, the problem is it's like a trap. There's nobody who would buy that land, even if he's legal owner of that land. Nobody would want to buy that land 7 kilometers deep inside the forest and would start wanting to live there. So he can't dispose his agricultural property. That's one. Secondly, even if there was a buyer, it would be very, very cheap. At the same, with the same money, he won't be able to buy an equivalent extent of land just outside the forest. Mm. So I kind of termed that as a spatial poverty trap, that they're trapped in these small settlements without any help or help for transition to an area. I'm not telling they need to, they have aspirations to go to the city. They just want to come to places where there are these basic amenities like road and school. So they're not even able to do that because they cannot find a buyer who would pay them that much. At the same time, so right now, I think our region, at least my district, is in that transition. When we speak to, I don't have the statistics though, but when we speak to people living in the villages, I hear more than 70% of the households, they don't have their children living with them. They're all old people, the youngsters are all migrated to the city, and they're left with this big land, and we have a huge labor problem in this region. Compared to other areas, it's a lot more severe in this region. You don't have any laborers available, and these are all agricultural areas where you need a lot of labor to maintain it and sustain it, and people are getting old and they're no longer able to sustain it. So people are disposing of their agricultural property quite a bit. And so whom do they sell it to is a question. At the same time, probably Karnataka hasn't had an advantage till now because non-agriculturists cannot buy agricultural property.
Okay.
So in terms of buyers, it's very limited. Only agriculturists can buy agricultural property compared to other states where anybody can buy agricultural property. So you still have these lot of green, comparatively natural areas without any big corporates coming in and doing these large agricultural farming and destroying even more. But we're probably in a transition phase. I don't know when government will let non-agriculturists buy land, and that time the big wave will come. So if we strategically think about it, it's a window of time where we can really take advantage of the situation and try to consolidate as much as possible for nature. It's a big window now, but I don't know how many of them see it. We're hoping the government can see it, but we need to do a lot more studies and present it in a proper form for the government to take some decisions on that. But sadly, that's a long way to go. But I think it's worth putting it in perspective to the government.
A window of opportunity that may not be taken or even recognized by the people in power. Surely something that wherever you live, you've probably felt at some point or another as well. similar in Karnataka. Now, at the end here, I asked Niden what the focus should be. He's an architect, also a conservationist in many ways. Some say, indeed, you know, conserving and making things sustainably and that kind of thing, technology, that's the road you got to take for a better future and a better environment. On the other hand, of course, Niden has been telling us about the whole thing of taking action, you yourself, standing, moving, doing. So which one is it for the future of India?
I had this big, when I was in college doing architecture, I thought energy efficiency, and that is what I was focused on. That is what my passion was. And we were trying to do a lot of energy efficient buildings. Even today, I try to do that. But I realized by the time it reaches these forests, I think it would be gone much before that. The slow, sustainable processes, it would take forever. And before that, these forests would be cut down and it would be gone. I don't think it would reach it so quickly. So that's why I thought, unless we do direct interventions and at the field itself, rather than trying to change people here, and that would probably take several hundreds of years. We need to have some areas where you need direct interventions and protect it. And these slow, sustainable changes is needed, but it's much slower and the process will go on. But it won't stop these, the core areas and the beautiful evergreen forests from being cut at the short term. But sadly, most of the environmentalists, they advocate only the sustainable development, only the sustainable movement and environmentalism, which I don't believe. I don't believe that is going to reach these forests so quickly and quick enough, because it's going to go within 10-20 years if we don't do direct intervention, and they're advocating against that. Whereas I don't believe that. I believe we need both. We need direct interventions to save these with the system, with the government mechanism itself. Finally, it is we. I mean, the government is us. I mean, lot of organizations alienate the government totally in telling that, blaming everything on the government. But government is a reflection of people. So we do believe that. In spite of, there are good and bad people in the government. That's always there, like in any society. So we need to work constructively with them for these. At the same time, we need to look at our own consumption levels and get it down to a sustainable level. But that's for a much longer, probably a few centuries.
Niren Jain is an architect based in Mangalore, Karnataka. You can see his work, and I strongly suggest you have a look at njarchitect.wordpress.com. And that about does it for this week's program. Our theme music was by the great Nick Aflito. Songs on this podcast were also by V. Nessie and Jonas78, both published and available on the Free Music Archive, my favorite place, published under CC licenses, as is this program. And a big thank you to my producer for this one, that's Chinmay. Thank you so much. And yeah, indeed, you know, I'm back from India, but India is still very present. The series continues because I recorded all these different interviews about all these different topics, and I really want to share them. So if you don't mind, a little more India as we push forth into 2017. Maybe it's good for all of us anyway to hear something other than from that orange-colored president. All right, that's it for the program. CitizenReporter.org is where the rest of the series can be found. And hey, if you've got the time, head on over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And yes, write a review. Why do podcasters always talk about this? Unfortunately, because this is the way that you get a little more profile, a little more found. And that is part of this whole process, the idea that people are listening and we're sharing in this experience, even if at this very moment, I don't hear your voice. I'll hear it later once I press publish. All right, that's it. Until next time, I'm Mark Fonseca Renderu. Take care. Thanks for listening. See ya.
We hold this land in trust. A trust we dare not carelessly betray. Our great scenic splendors are one of our most vital resources, deserving of devoted care and protection. The challenge is so great, and the solution so simple, let's not fail. We and all the generations of the long future will be rewarded with endless enjoyment and renewed inspiration.
What's
the sound? Tell us. I'll record it anyway.
That's a garbage collection. They announced that you need to separate the wet garbage and the dry garbage, and that they're coming to pick it up.
Okay. This recording is always playing. Yeah.
So that's a garbage truck coming. So they'll come here. It'll get even louder.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.